I feel as close as I ever have been to our ecosystem, but I feel close to it in a different way.
Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome to episode 135 of Rogue Startups, and today we have our special mystery guest who is no longer a mystery, Mr. Rob Walling. Rob, how the heck are you?
What's up, gents? Great to see you. I'm doing good today.
Good, good. You're probably a man that needs very little introduction in our community and our audience, but, you know, why don't you go ahead and throw out a few sentences there of whatever you'd like to say about yourself?
Yeah, this has become harder to do as the longer I've done this because there's more things, but I think probably the top couple are the co-founder of MicroConf, co-host of Startups for the Rest of Us, co-founder of Drip. Those seem like the big ones. And author of Start Small, Stay Small. Oh, husband of Sherry Walling as well, as she is motioning to me right now.
Which is becoming a more important one all the time, right?
That's going to be my lead in my bio here in the next year or two.
I think so, yeah. And you save the most important one for last. That's the point you want to emphasize, right?
Exactly.
So today we wanted to have Rob on to talk about life post lead pages. So for those of you that were somehow hiding under a rock, Drip was acquired by Lead Pages a couple of years ago, and Rob has recently left and is now, as his badge said at MicroConf this year, unemployed. And let's just start off with that. Like, how does that feel, man? You're semi-retired now. What's that like?
It's really cool, actually. It's everything you would imagine it to be. So far, I'm about a month into that. And the hardest part has been when I took one of my kids to the doctor, and they were like, so what do you do for a living? And it's like, well, I'm a software guy. And they're like, are you currently employed? And it was like, well, technically, no, but you're not going to write unemployed, right? And so I was like, I'm self-employed. Just say I'm self-employed. So that was so funny. I don't know why I have this stigma in my head about it. But yeah, other than that, I mean, just to get so much time back and to be able to put my thoughts into stuff that I'm interested in. I mean, this has been my dream since I was a kid or since college, you know, where I thought, boy, I don't want to go work in a cubicle and work on stuff other people think is important. I just someday want to have enough freedom, and I'm assuming I'm going to get there by having enough money to not have to work for other people. And that is really, I hit that freedom line, you know, and it really is like no regrets and no downsides so far. I know that in 6 months, I'm going to be bored out of my mind and you know, clawing at the walls to do the next thing. But so far, I feel like I'm in the honeymoon phase.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, you know, we were all cheering for you as you got acquired by Lead Pages and, you know, progressed through that whole thing and built up your team inside of there. But tell us a little bit about, you know, what was life like inside of Lead Pages? You know, you ran your own team inside of there. Was that everything that you thought it would be? Was it a nightmare? Was it somewhere in between? You know, how did that work out?
Yeah, overall, so yeah, I did run, I was the VP of product. So I ran, I managed all the engineers and set the product vision. So a lot of what I was doing pre-acquisition, I did a lot of that with my co-founder, Derek. I handed off marketing, which early on was really hard for me because I felt like it's just such, you know, it's my voice and I've written every line of copy, you know, then all these emails and on all this stuff and how are they going to change it? That was hard to hand off at first, but boy, within a month or two, it was like a huge weight off my shoulders. Overall, my experience, you know, if you were to look at it from being like a complete shit show, which I hear some post-acquisition, experiences described as, and versus just being, you know, kind of a dream, like a really good acquisition, it actually was a lot closer to a good experience. I mean, it was a good experience. There were certainly some things that we ran into, like, you know, going from essentially a 10-person company to 160, 170, just that the size was tough to navigate at first. The communication, suddenly instead of just being able to talk in a room with two or three people, define the roadmap and everything, I had to like create slide decks, and I had to communicate that to the sales team and then to the support team and then to management, you know, and all that stuff is just kind of agonizing for someone like me, because I prefer to build products rather than talk about building products, you know, building slide decks to talk about it. So that kind of stuff really wore on me. I mean, the corporate, and LeadPage it's a startup, right? I mean, they're not a super corporate environment. And yet, even just that little bit, you know, really, really wore on me. I had to do some board meetings as well, and I didn't love those, as you can imagine. I do realize that there's a reason that I haven't raised funding. It's because I just don't know if I could put up with the kind of the BS of it. And then on the flip side, I mean, those were some of the negatives. On the flip side, I was given a ton of leeway, a ton of budget. We were able to hire way, way faster than I was. So there were a bunch of positives that actually my life got less stressful after the acquisition because of I was now not on the hook for financial responsibility, in essence, which, you know, meaning like I didn't have to worry about making payroll. You know, and I didn't have to make these hard like AWS decisions, like do I shut down these servers on the weekend because there's a lower amount of traffic so I can save $500. I mean, it was, you know, all that went away. So it was, you know, certainly there were pluses and minuses. But overall, for me, the experience, like I have no regrets, and there was nothing. There's never been a day that's gone by that I thought to myself, man, I really wished I hadn't sold the company.
Interesting.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. That's great. So what do you attribute the overall kind of positive experience of the acquisition and working at LeadPages to? I mean, you obviously did a lot of things right going into it. What do you think some of those biggest things were to set yourself up for success?
So setting myself up for success post-acquisition?
Yeah.
Is that what you were thinking? Well, I mean, there were a couple things. One is, it helped that the company was small enough that I was essentially negotiating with the person who I would be reporting to, right? That was the CEO, Clay Collins. So I had kind of the luxury that you don't have if you're acquired by Dell, you know, or Google, where you're like dealing with their business, or I'm sorry, their corporate development guys who've done hundreds of acquisitions. You're going to do one, and then you're now handed off to some manager somewhere who doesn't know all the nuance of all the conversation you had, right? And so they're, if it's not in writing, boy, they're not living up to anything. Whereas I mean, we were approached by several companies to buy us, right? So I had the choice. I should say we, Derek and myself, my co-founder, had the choice to kind of figure out who we wanted to talk to. And the fact that we had a player like LeadPages, where I knew Clay was going to be a pretty straight shooter, and I believed that what he was telling me was actually going to happen. So I think that was that set me up for success, because the words that came out of his mouth, I believed them, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was saying like, look, we don't want to ruin the company. Like, you guys ship software fast. Drip is a good product. You're a small team. You're getting a lot done. Why would I bring it in and just dismantle that? You know, that's how acquisitions break companies often. But what about looking at it more like the Facebook Instagram model, where Facebook acquired Instagram, but they didn't go in and change a bunch of stuff. It's really kind of still autonomous, right? But there's some integrations. That's what Clay kept coming back to as a metaphor of like, let's make you the Instagram, and we're going to acquire you, but just give you the resources you need and not clog things up. So again, that's the second thing, is I kind of had that luxury to be able to ride that. When he said it, I was like, yes, that's a great idea, you know. But if he hadn't proposed that, can you imagine proposing that as an acquiree? Hey, I want you guys to leave us alone and give us a bunch of money. You know, it's like, you're nuts.
Right.
So yeah, that would be tough to swallow.
Yeah. So I think those were two good things. I think another thing is, you know, I've worked in corporate environments before. And again, not that LeadPages is that corporate, but when you have 160 people, you have, you know, HR handbooks, and you have culture documents and missions and values and all that stuff. If you had never done that before and you were suddenly dropped in that world, it can seem insane and really, you know, I don't know, just not appealing. I didn't love it, but at least I was familiar. I knew that at that scale, that's what would be there. And so when we got dropped in, it was still a weird culture shift for me, but I didn't kind of freak out, right? As I can imagine, you know, like Derek, my co-founder, I don't think he'd ever really worked in a certainly not a company that size, and didn't have, you know, I'd never been in the cubicle life. Even I keep referencing cubicles. It's an open office space, but you get the idea. Just being in a space with 150 people and trying to do stuff is a very different life than a 10 person startup.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, hugely so. And that's not even as bad as like the traditional Fortune 500 model, where it's battleship grade cubicles and, you know, corporate meetings where you have to rent a space for 400 people so that everybody can be in the same room at the same time and really bizarre stuff like that. Yeah.
That would be a really tough transition. And I've heard people talk about that, like Paul Graham, when they were acquired by Yahoo in the late 90s, he said it was just agonizing during his earnout. And I have a couple friends who I talked to who have been, if I said the name of their company, you'd recognize them, but they were acquired, and talked to them, and they talked about how hard it was. One guy referred to it as going to jail. He basically said, look, I know you have to stick around for a little while to make all, you know, to get all your money. Consider it jail time. Would you go to jail for this amount of time? And I like, boy, that's certainly a bleak outlook. I mean, it's a great worst case, but I was really hoping it would not be that bad. And it wasn't, right? It wasn't for me, but his experience was that it was pretty catastrophic.
So what was the kind of worst part or the biggest challenge personally, like either in selling the business or kind of in that time after you sold the business until whatever, a month ago, until you left?
Yeah. I mean, the worst part about selling the business was the stress for me. You know, there were moments when I said a sentence to Sherry, my wife, at one point, and I said, you know, I could say the wrong sentence and lose $1 million. Like, I could make a $1 million mistake at any time. And that pressure was like, it was like 5 months of being so careful with my words, because you're on a call and you just don't want to flippantly overcommit to something. You don't want to flippantly, you know, and some of it's about price, but other of it is about earnout duration. And it's about, you know, whether you keep the employees on or not. I mean, there's all these terms that get negotiated, and that negotiation, unfortunately, you can't just hire a chief negotiator and say, these are my terms. If they don't meet them, I'm done, because it just doesn't work that way. You have to be involved in these things. You know, I had a broker working with me, advising me, and it was still extremely stressful for me for about 5 months. And so that took a toll on me. And of course, it took a toll on my relationships, you know. So that was probably the hardest part going into it. And the hardest part after was definitely the adjustment to a larger org with a bit of a different culture. You know, LeapPages has always been a very marketing-centric culture. We were more of a product-centric culture. And then even later on, the CEO switched from Clay Collins to the new CEO, John Tedesco. And he's definitely more of a Fortune 500 mindset, right? He wants to get big and really put a lot of, you know, he puts a lot of structure in place for where, you know, it's like, we can get to 100 million. I'm going to put that structure in place now. That John and I get along great. And I, you know, still like him and hang out with him and such. But the added structure was pretty stifling to me. And I think that started to conflict with what I wanted to do on a day-to-day basis, you know?
Do you think there's things about, talking about culture, because I think a lot of us have like the future in mind when we're working today. Like we say, okay, in a couple of years, I hope my business will be like this or this or this. From a culture perspective, are there things that you learned either building Drip or getting into LeapPages and seeing their culture there that, like, for folks like us who are kind of still on the journey and you're at the end, you got to the end of the game, like, would you go back and say, yeah, that's important for culture, or you need culture, this part of, you know, company culture to be successful or to get to some of these milestones they're all looking for?
I think that once you hit about, it's around 15 employees, you need to have some deliberate list of things that you all value together, that you agree on. I think when you're maybe it's at 20, it depends on how, you know, if you're fully remote versus if you're all in person. Our team of 10, which was two contractors and eight full-time, I was able to, just by my personality and being really specific about who we hired, you know, Derek and I were able to just craft the culture without ever having to write anything down, right? Like our, whatever it is, like your values and such. But I think that, I'm pretty sure that will break down. I know it breaks down eventually. and I'm from what I'm hearing from like Paldi at Balsamic, a couple of the friends I've talked to, it's in that 15 to 20 person range. And so that's what I'd say, as weird as it feels and as cheesy as it feels as bootstrappers when you're three people, to have anything written down like that, it has to happen eventually if you're going to grow to that point. But I believe, you know, if Drip had stayed independent, if we would have had to hire more people, but just because of the rate we were growing, but if we hadn't, I wouldn't have rushed to write anything down. But I do think culture is really hard, and if you're not deliberate about it, it will just develop. And hiring is a big part of that, right? About being very picky about who you hire. If you want to see a good list, you know, there's a bunch of values things all around, but Balsamic has a good one. It's called the Balsamic Mantras, and there's six of them. And I respect Peldy's approach to this stuff a lot. He's pretty deliberate and he's really thoughtful about it. And that's one of the least corporate approaches to it that I've seen.
Yeah, he actually had something. It was before they had formed the official mantras. He presented it at MicroConf. It was sort of like, here are the things that we value. And I don't know if it was a list of six at the time or not, but it was kind of that same thing. And he was still sort of formulating in his mind what that looked like. But even then, he was still pretty intentional about that culture thing. And I think the rest of us all sort of looked at that going, we could sort of figure that out with culture because we're just not that big yet. But yep. That's very, very different when you get to a certain size. Yeah.
Yep. And you got to be, like I said, I think being deliberate about it and thinking it through is the first step. And the other step is to be super picky about who you hire, because within, you know, when we got there, lead pages was 150, 160, and there were just a couple people who weren't good culture fits, or they were just a little bit toxic, you know, just, you know, the people you've worked with them, you know, and it didn't take very many out of all those to kind of derail entire units of the business, you know, because they just kind of impacted everybody else. So it was pretty noticeable from the outside coming in of like, oh boy, okay. So this individual or that, you know, this handful of people, again, it was a very small number, but there had been some mishires, and those were cleaned out pretty quickly. I think within 6 months of us getting acquired, all the people who I identified really early on were let go or laid off or whatever. I think that certainly helped them kind of clean things up.
So now that you've got this big windfall, I heard that you went on to eBay and purchased a DeLorean, and you're currently installing the flux capacitor for it. So when you go back to go visit yourself in 2015, what would be the piece of advice that you want to give yourself about selling your business into a larger company that you sort of missed this time around? And I expect you to come by with a DeLorean after you're done. I've got a few things I need to fix as well.
Yeah, that's. I can imagine that. If I can get that thing running, man. I've heard these DeLoreans are like a fiasco to get started. I actually looked at them on eBay just for kicks. It's funny you mention that. But I was just like, hey, I'm on eBay. I'm looking at crazy stuff, and people are like, these are so hard to keep running. You know, it's all custom parts. What's interesting is the things that jumped to mind were a lot of the things that I regret were a lot of internal to me, like. I put so much pressure on myself for such an extended duration that if I were to do this again, or if I were to go back to 2015, I would say, you need to relax. You need to chill the heck out, and you need to have a little more trust in everybody that you're dealing with. Because for some reason, my initial, you know, conversation with everyone is like, oh, they're trying to put one over on me. You know, just because you've heard the stories of the startup founder who gets duped when they're, you know, they bait and switch, and then last minute they change the price and they just do all that stuff. And that was never any, you know, Clay's intention. It was never anybody on their side's intention. But I really looked at people with suspicion, you know, until they proved it to me. And I just think I could have chilled out a little bit, you know, and it helps to know that things worked out. But I think people just aren't as conniving as I was making it out in my head. The problem was the stakes were just so high, you know, that I really didn't want to make, a six or seven figure mistake. That might be the single biggest thing that if I were to go through it again, that I would try to change. I can't think of anything in the terms. I mean, I negotiated really hard, right, for a lot of months, and the deal fell apart multiple times. And I was looking back because I'm kind of writing about it now just to process it. And there was like an email from Clay in, because the thing closed on July 1 of 2016, and there was an email from him sometime in April maybe, and it was like, hey, sorry things fell apart, or, you know, it's a bummer to hear things fell apart, but like, I just want you to know, like, no hard feelings, you know. And I was just like, yeah, oh, that, it literally was done. It was done. It was not a ploy. It was not a negotiation from either of us. It was a done deal. And I've since circled back and talked to him and the current CEO. And I was like, was that legit? And he's like, oh yeah, we weren't doing tactics. Like, we were literally just trying to acquire you guys, you know? So given the fact that it was such a painful negotiation, I know that I think both sides kind of got what they wanted, you know, which is probably the best kind of negotiation. So I don't have major regrets about any of the deal points.
I think we could talk for a whole episode about negotiation and strategy and stuff, but maybe that'll be the next time we have you on, because I'd love to dig into that, because I think that's all something we hope we get to go through at some point in the future. I'm very tempted to go down that rabbit hole right now. But for those of us who, again, are kind of like still on the journey, you've had like a lot of experience, obviously, and success in SaaS and bootstrapping. But kind of a little bit from the outside now, and from where you've kind of come, where do you see SaaS going in the next few years? And I guess particularly for those of us who are either bootstrapped or fund-strapped or whatever you call it, just taking a little bit of money.
Yeah, I mean, the trends that I'm seeing, one big one is just the competition. Like the fact that Wall Street and really everyone in the world now, you know, in the tech and the finance world, is aware of the value of recurring revenue. And as these SaaS apps like HubSpot and I'm trying to think Dropbox and Box and those guys, as the subscription services have gone public, there's a lot of popularity. And so that is leading to a ton of competition in any horizontal niche right now. You know, if you're not picking like a vertical market, it is brutal to get started. I cannot imagine just launching a horizontal SaaS today compared even to 5 years ago. You just need some competitive advantage, you know, whether it's buckets of money or you need, you know, an existing audience, or you need a really good network in that space. Or you need, you know, all of that stuff, basically. So that's one trend I see, is it's just getting more competitive. And so I think niching down has always been a good way to do it. I think you may even have to go even tighter than in the old days, you know, than 4 or 5 years ago. And the second trend I'm seeing, and it's something you just mentioned, but it's this term fund strapping. And that term was coined by Colin from, he's the CEO of customer.io. And the idea there is that you raise a single round, typically a single angel round, of between, let's say, 250 and 500K, with the plans that you're never going to raise an institutional round, right? You're never going to raise money from institutional investors like venture capitalists. Because as soon as you do that, it's a point of no return, right? Because they expect a big return and they expect subsequent rounds. Typically, you raise every 18 months, expect you to scale up your headcount. You know, you lose. That's where you get the boards and you get people getting fired from their own company as CEO, and you do lose some control and you feel more pressure. But this fund strapping round, if you take it from, you know, a handful of angels or whatever, it's a very different vibe, and it's more akin to, you know, starting a, let's say, a dry cleaner or a car wash or a restaurant. That's how those tend to start, is they raise one round and they expect to get to profitability. So that trend I have seen becoming more and more common, just doing that, and, you know, people doing more and more of it in the past couple of years. And I think a big reason for that is because, A, they want to get there faster, but B, because of my first point, which was there's just so much more competition, it's harder to do now.
Yeah. Do you think you almost need some kind of funding these days to be able to compete if you're starting from scratch?
I think need is a little too strong. I think that...
Strongly encourage.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I'm the bootstrapping guy, right? I've been bootstrapping for years and talking about it for about as long. I don't believe you need funding to do it. I still think that you can start a SaaS and be successful. I just think it's definitely a long road. And I also think that if you're going to do it without funding, or you're going to self-fund it, that you need to be narrower in your customers, your customer base, than who you probably want to or would have been 2-3 years ago. So instead of building invoicing software for XYZ, like I would get I'd get a pretty dang tight niche and try to get, you know, just 50 people to pay me to kind of prove it out. So mm-hmm. I think there's, yeah, I guess I'm saying it's more competitive. It's still totally doable. And I actually think fund strapping is really not for everyone, right? It's like you have to be in a space. If you're going to build a SaaS app, that's a great lifestyle business that's going to be, let's just say, $250,000 a year in revenue, right? Or $250,000 a year in profit. You know, that just that's an awesome lifestyle business. Don't fund strap for that. Like, if that's where it's going to peak, and you're going to build, you know, proposal software for designers, or you're going to build invoicing software for salons or whatever, those tend to be smaller businesses. To fund strap, you do have to have some type of growth potential. Like, you need to be able to get in the seven figures unless you cut a very generous deal on the valuation. So it's, you know, I was saying, I talked a little bit about this at my MicroConf talk, and I was kind of saying, you know, fund strapping is certainly not for everyone, and maybe it's 1 in 20 people in this room, you know, at growth. I still think that 90%+, the vast majority, you know, of us should still do it the old-fashioned way. Just know that it's going to take a long time, and I think you're going to probably have to start pretty focused to kind of get that momentum.
Well, I was going to follow up and ask a question about, did you think that maybe there's a size of fund strapping that works at a smaller scale? Because you're talking at like $250,000, $500,000. That's a lot of scratch for businesses that are at our size. You know, is there a 50,000 fund strapping that makes sense at certain sizes, or a 30,000 fund strapping, or, you know, something smaller? Or do you think that's just not on the table for until you're past a certain size?
You know, I haven't seen anyone do that, but it's not to say that it couldn't be some type of creative financing, you know, for a business that's just going to have smaller payback potential. You'd probably need, let's say it's going to do $250,000 a year in free cash flow, and the founder wants to take 150 or 200 off the table. You know, if you put 30 in on something that's just getting started, or 50 in, the valuation would just have to make sense, so that if it worked, that person gets paid back in a few years, given the risk of this fund strapping model. From the investor's perspective, it would just have to make sense. So I think that's feasible, but I would almost want to run numbers and think more about it. I'm sure that, you know, if we talk to any, certainly an institutional investor is going to scoff at this idea and say, well, that'll never work because all my returns come from the outsized investments, right? Or the outsized returns, all the Dropboxes and the Ubers, the ones that go, 100x or 1000x. But if we're talking about a model where no, I'm actually getting 10% or 20% of the net profit until I'm paid back, or until I'm paid back 2x, you can structure a deal. Again, similar, that's how, you know, restaurants and car washes are structured. I think it could be feasible. The biggest question in my mind I'd have to think about is, let's say I wrote you a check for 30K or a check for 50K. Does that do enough for you that it actually supercharges the business? You know, does it actually help you move faster? Or is it just not enough money? Because it's not really enough to hire somebody for a full year, right?
It might be enough to do like some heavy duty marketing if you knew that you already had product market fit and you just didn't have the budget for it because you were already spending maybe that on a developer or something like that, you know.
Yep.
I mean, I could see some creative uses of it. I was just curious what your perspective on it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a TBD thing. I think I like thinking about these new and creative ways, just like you're saying, like micro fund strapping. Like, that's a cool idea. But I'm also hesitant to like think that they'll just naturally work if they've never been tried, because this stuff's pretty complicated. You know, there's a lot of moving parts with it.
Oh yeah, definitely. And the thing that I found interesting this year, and I'm sure you noticed this as well at MicroConf Growth, just the sheer number of investment groups that were there. You know, you had the guys from Empire Flippers, you had the guys from FE International, you had Sure Swift Capital, you had the, what was it, Boot something Capital? Boot?
Bigfoot.
It was like something to do with foot. Bigfoot Capital. And there were probably some others that might have been in stealth mode on top of that. But like, that's the first year I've seen that many investors kind of hobnobbing with the businesses. I mean, Thomas and those guys have been there for years. They've been hanging out with us for a long time. But this was kind of the first time I saw, you know, small scale VCs hanging out with everybody, kind of sniffing everybody's butts. So
yeah,
obviously we're attracting some attention there for that reason.
Yep. I mean, as the competition has developed and people see the value of these businesses, this secondary market has developed, right? The secondary market being FE International and Empire Flippers and Quiet Light and even Latonis. Where you can build a SaaS app up and you can sell it for 3 or 4 times the annual net profit, that market didn't exist 5 years ago, right? You could go onto Flippa and sell it for 12 months or 18 months. It was ridiculous. But the fact that we're now getting multiples like that is you know, it's not amazing, but it's pretty damn cool. It's pretty damn cool that when you get bored of a WordPress plugin that's making you $25K a year, that you can sell that for $75K. Like that is a noticeable chunk of change for you to then take and invest in your next one. So I think there's a lot of value to that. And yeah, that you're right. There were four kind of two of those are brokers, right? Of the companies you named, and then one of them lends monies to SaaS companies in essence based on their revenue. So it is a way to kind of take advantage of your revenue, not have to give up equity and be able to grow the business, but you know it's in essence a loan, and so you're making payments. So there's obviously a plus and minus to doing that.
Definitely. All right, so my next question here is kind of a joke, but it's not really a joke. Do you feel disconnected from the bootstrapping community now that you've sold and moved on and you're just kind of hanging out there? You don't have a product. You still got the podcast, but, you know, does that make you feel like you split some connections there?
like I'm the old guy at the club? I'm not that old. I'm just
you're the only one checking out DeLoreans on eBay. That's for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't going to buy one. That was just a joke. But yeah, you know, man, the answer is yes and no. I think that I'm not thinking about the same things that I was thinking and talking about 5 years ago, because that to me, it was all about, I'm going to build companies, I'm going to grow them. So it was growth, you know, growth hacks. We didn't call them that, but it's marketing approaches. How can I run Facebook ads? How can I grow 10x this company? All that. That part of it, I'm a little bit, I don't know if this will be permanent, but I'm a little bit done with talking about all that. Like if you were to bring me on here and ask like, what are your favorite, you know, what are the big growth tips? How are startups growing these days? It's like, oh God, like I've spent so much of my startup career thinking about those things that I need to kind of take a pause on that. Maybe it'll be permanent, but that I'm done with. With that said, I feel like I now have such a, like I've seen the journey from start to finish now, right? And you could argue I've seen it start to finish for several apps at different scales, right? So I've seen it.
Right. Multiple times, multiple scales. Yep. Absolutely.
These little apps that did $1,000 to $5,000 a month that I would, you know, I sold some of those for between 10 and 50K each, right? When I actually sold all the rights to them. And then, you know, Hittail, which I got up to 30K a month and sold it for a reasonable six figure sum. You know, it wasn't 105,000. Like it was a substantial amount of money. It was at the time, it was life changing in the sense of I could have taken quite a bit of time off. And then, you know, to see Drip take that to the next level, I feel like my perspective is so much clearer than it was 4 or 5 years ago on the entire journey. And I actually have a bunch of stuff rattling around in my head where I'm suddenly have this urge to start blogging again, because I feel like I have like strong opinions about things that I just wasn't sure of a few years ago. And it's things about the broader, it's like starting a startup, it's mindset stuff. It's like almost one level higher than I've perhaps traditionally talked about. So like talking about tactics, I don't know that I'm ever going to go back to doing that. But if you think of essays like, you know, like Paul Graham's essays or any other startup writer who's not talking about running Facebook ads, but is still interesting in talking about stuff we like, that's kind of the stuff that's in my head at this point. Does that make sense at all? It's like this one level above.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, I was kind of thinking when you were talking about this, that it's almost like you've gotten to a metadata level of thinking, about startups themselves, because you've now seen that from different perspectives. And so now you can start to isolate patterns and then find things that, where there's commonalities and things are falling apart in similar ways, but they don't look similar until you've gone through all of those different steps. And then you're like, oh, it's just the same story getting retold in a different and worse way over here.
That's a good way to put it. Yep. It's more pattern matching. I've also done, you know, close to a dozen angel investments, and I'm seeing their numbers, and I'm talking to those guys on a monthly, every few month basis. And so all of it, plus with MicroConf and, you know, just all the conversations I have, for free telling entrepreneurs what to do and that kind of stuff. It really does feel like, I don't know if this, I'm trying to think if this is true, but it's like, I feel as close as I ever have been to our ecosystem, but I feel close to it in a different way, and that I'm not sitting in it, you know, but I'm almost like you said, seeing it from a meta level now and really starting to think in terms of patterns rather than, oh, this is what I'm doing and I'm going to talk about that. You know, it's more like this feels like what everyone's doing. You know, when you asked about trends, it's like I'm starting to think in terms of that kind of stuff. you know, in terms of where the whole space is headed, rather than thinking about, oh, what's my next idea? You know, I used to spend so much time thinking about and sketching out startup ideas, and that's, I just don't know that that's going to happen for me again.
Yeah. Well, as a quick follow-up to that, do you think that stair-stepping is the same now as it was 5 years ago when you first started talking about that?
Yeah, I do. I still think that's the way I would go if I were starting out today. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's starting with a small, typically a single sale product, a small purchase price, and typically a single source of traffic. So a WordPress plugin is a great example of that, or even an Amazon product or an information product. You just got to get confidence. You need to get confidence that you can write copy and that you can support it and that you're so, you know, confused when you start. You don't know anything. And then once you have one success, it's like, oh, I made 10 grand from this thing. I'm not going to retire on that, but you gain this confidence, you gain experience, and you gain a little bit of money, and then parlay that money up into multiple, and then eventually recurring revenue is kind of the way I sketched it out. I still think I still see it being done and being done really well. And with the interesting thing is with these secondary markets, like I was talking about, see, those didn't really exist when I first started talking about stair-stepping. And so I never said, sell one of your early WordPress plugins or sell an early, you know, whatever it is, info product or Adobe Photoshop add-on. But think about it this way. Instead of just building something up to a grand a month, like I used to talk about, it's like, what if you can go and sell that for 40 or 50K? That's even more, you know, you kind of bootstrap your own or you self-fund your own startup off of that now. So that's like one interesting twist that I see some people doing is starting that first one and then, you know, jump into SaaS after that because they have a bit more money in the bank than they otherwise would have if they were just waiting for the slow bleed of the income.
So Rob, now that you've been kind of without work, I'll say, for about a month, and I know Sherry is kind of very conscious of keeping your mental health top notch. What do you think will be the hardest part about this transition into kind of really having all of your own time and being able to decide what you want to do with it?
Well, I think the hardest part's going to be deciding what to do with it because in the past there's always been a necessity and it's like, well, I need to start something to make money and I don't have to do that anymore. So how can I possibly tackle something that's really hard and going to be really stressful, which most startups are, if I don't have to do that? You know what I mean? It's like, how can I sign myself up for that? So I need to get in a mental state where if I'm going to do something hard, I need to figure out why and figure out why I really want to do that rather than just, I don't want to be impulsive and come up with this idea and then get into it and then get 3 months in and be like, oh my God, this is really hard. I forgot how hard this is. Boy, I don't need this, and just shut it down. Right? That would be like the worst thing to do. So I think just being deliberate about deciding what I'm going to do next, which is light. I mean, said this, it's likely not another startup. You know, I'm not super wild about just starting something from scratch. Again, done it a lot of times, and I feel kind of like I've learned what I could from those experiences, and I'm looking for another, you know, I think a different experience, and just got to figure out what that will be.
Hey, I hear Bill and Melinda Gates have an opening on their World Malaria Board. Sweet. You could always apply for
Sweet.
That.
Yeah, I'm on a couple boards. I might as well sign up for that.
No, I think what you said, I mean, rings true. I mean, I tell my wife that I'll never be retired. I mean, we might sell one day and have enough money to not have to work for a period of time. But yeah, I mean, a month, I think I commend you for going a month without getting your hands into something because I go nuts if we have like an afternoon free at home and I'm like, I'll just creep up to the office and knock out some email or whatever. And I mean, just can't imagine, quote, not working. Because for a lot of us, it has a lot to do with our identity and our kind of sense of purpose. And I know you're like all of the rest of us, really competitive driven person. So like to just kind of hang out and take the kids to school is great, but it does kind of take away from your value or your own perceived value of yourself, I think.
Yeah. And that'll be the other big struggle, right? Is both the perceived value of myself as well as FOMO. Right. When I see people doing interesting things in the startup space and it's like, oh, I'm not doing that right now. You know, I'm not building that interesting business. Like, it's really hard to kind of feel on the sidelines, which is why I'm thinking, running MicroConf a couple weeks ago was really helpful because I had a bunch of work to do. And you know, now I'm already thinking about next year's, and I'm starting to blog more. I'm writing, I may be working on a book right now. I don't know if it'll turn into that, but assuming that happens, that's a cool project for me to do. And it keeps me in the startup space because it's all I'm thinking about in the book, right? It's all I'm talking about. And then two podcasts, and I'm thinking about, you know, reigniting my blog, in which case I would still be thinking about startups enough to keep me interested, if that makes sense. You know, I don't necessarily need to build one, I think, at this point to stay in the mindset of, boy, I'm still here. I'm still playing the game.
So, Rob, is there a particular place you want people to look at or pay attention to over the next 6 months if they want to keep up on all things Rob Walling?
Yeah, folks can head to robwalling.com. I just got that domain a couple months ago from the prior owner, and I'm having it redirected over to my brand new website that was just designed. That was another fun project that I took on over the past month. Was it's like, hey, I need to redo this identity. I haven't had time in years, you know. Work with a designer, but it's nice when you have some free time to just kind of do those things that you want to cross off the list.
Nice. And if anybody out there in the audience has any questions for Rob or stuff you want us to give him shit about being unemployed, send us an email to podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you're liking how things are going, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review on iTunes. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.